Okay, today we will be studying Sutta number 18 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Madhupindika Sutta, the discourse on the honey ball. And we get to see why the sutta has this name only when we come to the very end of this. Okay, so this sutta begins when the Buddha is living in the Sakya country. The Sakya country was the Buddha's own native land, since the Buddha came from the Sakya Republic. And we call him Sakyamuni, which means the sage of the Sakya clan. And so he was living near Kapalabhattu. Kapalabhattu was the capital of the Sakya Republic, in a place called the Rotas Park. Okay, so one morning, as usual, the Buddha, after dressing, he goes into the city on alms round. Then after he returns from his alms round, he enters into a certain woods in order to spend the day sitting in meditation. And so he sits at the root of a bilva sapling in order to spend the day. You know what the bilva is? It's a kind of tree that grows in South Asia. It's singular, we call it the Delhi tree. And it has a fruit, which is a round fruit with a hard shell. You have to crack the shell with a machete. And it has a fruit inside, a little bit like a pumpkin texture, which is something bitter and sweet at the same time. Sometimes it's more bitter than sweet. And it's supposed to be very good for the digestion. Okay, so while the Buddha is sitting there, somebody who is identified as Dandapani the Sakya is walking, taking a walk, and he enters the great wood, and he sees the Buddha sitting under the bilva sapling and comes up to him. Okay, this word or this name by which the Sakya is known, Dandapani, it seems to be a nickname rather than a proper name, because it means literally stick in hand, one who has a stick in his hand. And so he must have been walking with a walking stick. Who he actually is, the sutta itself doesn't identify, doesn't give any clue to his identity. The commentary to the Pali Sutta identifies him as a Sakyan who was on the side of Devadatta. There was a division in the Sangha towards the end of the Buddha's lifetime in which the Buddha's cousin named Devadatta, who was envious of the Buddha and he wanted to actually overthrow the Buddha and usurp the position of being the head of the community. In fact, he says, he thinks to himself, I'll get rid of the Buddha and I will be the Buddha. And so he actually launched some assassination plots against the Buddha, hoping that his hired assassins would take the Buddha's life so that he could become the head of the Sangha. And so the commentary says that this Dandapani was a follower of Devadatta, one who sympathized with him. But I'm not sure whether this is actually the case, because I get the impression from the sutta that the discourse is taking place at a fairly early time in the Buddha's ministry. Because Dandapani, he's going to ask the Buddha what he teaches, and so he didn't know what the Buddha taught. And the conflict with Devadatta came towards the end of the Buddha's life, maybe when the Buddha was about 70, 75 years old. Of course, Siddhartha tries to persuade the Buddha to step down voluntarily on the grounds that he's now old, too old to continue to administer the Sangha. So he says, I'm younger, let me take over, and you just twirl a tease. In any case, when the Buddha had left the household life to become an ascetic, it seems that some of the Sakyans were very unhappy with him because he was the son of one of the most prominent Sakyans of the time. In fact, in traditional legend, his father is said to be the king of the Sakyans. Though we know from the suttas that the Sakyans didn't have a kingship, but a republican form of government. But his father was evidently one of the more prominent members of the Sakyan clan, and his son left all of his responsibilities, his administrative responsibilities, to become an ascetic. And so the Sakyans were reputed to be very proud people, somewhat of an aristocratic clan, and so they were disappointed and some were upset with the Buddha for becoming an ascetic and then setting himself up, apparently, as a spiritual teacher. And so when the Buddha came back to visit the Sakyans, some of them, the elders in the Sakyan clan, wouldn't bow to him, show respect to him, offer him alms, but they would just blame him and criticize him. So it's possible that Dandapani belonged to that faction of the Sakyan elders. Okay, so when he sees the Buddha sitting under the tree, he comes up to him, and the text described their exchange. It uses a stock phrase that they exchange courteous and amiable talk. But it continues and says, he stood at one side leaning on his stick, and then he questions the Buddha. Now within Indian religious conventions, to be leaning on a stick while speaking to somebody who is a religious teacher is a sign of disrespect, unless one is very old and feeble. But apparently Dandapani was not so old and feeble. And so he's leaning on the stick, and he's asking the Buddha, again, the way the question is worded, it has a kind of impolite nuance to it, almost a kind of aggressive tone to it. He says, what does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim? Now, if he was speaking politely, even if he didn't accept the Buddha as his spiritual teacher, he would have addressed him as Bhante or Honorable Sir, or use some polite term. But he doesn't even use evocative, a term of address. And he just refers to the Buddha in this, it seems almost like in a disparaging tone. What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim? As though he's deliberately trying to say something provocative in order to pull the Buddha into an argument. Like by speaking a little aggressively, disrespectfully, he wants the Buddha to get angry with him. And then start arguing back with him or criticizing him. But the Buddha is going to answer in a way which sort of undermines the strategy of Dandapani. So he refers to him, I think the Pali must use the word abuso, which is translated here friend. It doesn't literally mean a friend in the sense of a companion, but it's a term that's a little bit respectful, but a little bit close. It's not a term that one uses to address somebody who is above one, but usually it's a term that one uses to address either equals or those who are a little below. He says, friend, I assert and proclaim, then I put in brackets my teaching, in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world. You see, the Buddha is trying to show that he avoids quarrels and disputes. So one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its devas, its maras, its brahmas, in this generation or population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its princes and people. Okay, then comes a rather difficult phrase, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie, or we could say lie within, lie dormant within, that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. It seems with this phrase, the Buddha was deliberately trying to perplex Dandapani, to make a statement that he wouldn't understand. And so he would give up trying to provoke the Buddha in argument. That's my impression anyway. And here the Buddha uses the word or expression, that Brahman. And so normally in the Indian social organization of that period, the Brahmins referred to people of a particular social class, those who were the priests who maintained the Vedas and performed the rituals and sacrifices prescribed in the Vedas. But the original meaning of Brahman was somebody who embodies the holy power, the divine power that sustains the universe. And so the word Brahman in its original sense would be translated something like a holy man. So the Buddha took this term Brahman and gave it, or tried to give it, a new meaning grounded in his own teaching. And so the Brahman would be the perfectly enlightened, perfectly liberated person. So it refers generally to the Arahant, and here it's actually referring indirectly to the Buddha himself. Even though the Buddha didn't come from the Brahmin clan, but from the Kshatriyas, or warrior class, but he uses sometimes the word Brahmin to refer to himself and to other disciples who have reached arhatship. Okay, so when the Buddha answers in this way, then Dandapani shakes his head, probably as a sign of perplexity, wags his tongue. I don't know what that and raises his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered into three lines. What does this signify?
Perplexity.
What is it?
Perplexity.
It seems to be a mixture of perplexity
and frustration.
Frustration, exactly. And maybe a little bit of anger there also. In any other country, if one gets perplexed, frustrated, angry, it just went one at a time. Okay, so then he leaves and he's still walking, leaning on his stick. Okay, then in the evening time, the Buddha returns to the Parva monastery, and then he tells the monks what had happened during the day. Okay, then one monk asked the Buddha, he wants to know how he proclaims his teaching in such a way that he does not quarrel with anyone in the world, and how it is that, again, perceptions no more lie latent within the Blessed One. Here he's explicitly referring to the Buddha as the Blessed One and then identifying him as that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being, any kind of conditioned existence. Okay, then the Buddha now will answer, give a somewhat difficult answer. I'll read it, and then then try to explain it according to my understanding. He says, as to the source through which, and here the translation is interpreted, the Pali is actually a bit obscure, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man or a person, if nothing is found there to delight in, to welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency to views, the underlying tendency to doubt, the underlying tendency to conceit, the underlying tendency to desire for being, for craving for existence, the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, the end of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Then when the Buddha said this, then without explanation, he gets up from his seat and goes into his dwelling. Okay, we have here in Pali, it's a very long, complicated sentence. Okay, we start, the key expression in this whole sutta is what is translated as perceptions and notions, then I put in brackets here, born of mental proliferation. The Pali expression, so what's translated as perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation, in the original it's a somewhat perplexing compound, papancha sanya sankha. It doesn't occur very often, in fact it occurs very seldom in the texts, and so we don't really find enough material to be able to draw out the definite, explicit interpretation or explanation. And so it's an expression that requires some degree of interpretation. Okay, so we have two words. One is sanya, which normally it's translated as perception, but it can also refer to the result of perception, which is ideas. And then we have another word, sankha, which comes from the original meaning is reckoning or counting, but it can also signify the way we interpret experience by means of concepts or notions. And so here we have perceptions and notions, and they're preceded by something called papancha. Papancha seems to suggest the process of, we call this mental elaboration, building up or construction, say fabrication. And so the way I understand it is that this is the elaboration, the fabrication of interpretations of experience, which affect our ideas and our concepts, so that even our perceptions get influenced by these tendencies to proliferation, to mental proliferation. And the commentaries explain this word papancha in terms of three mental factors, which are the factors responsible, primarily responsible for papancha, for this conceptual elaboration. The three factors at the base of papancha are: one is craving, the second is conceit, and the third is views. And so the way I understand it, what is meant by papancha is the way we elaborate or construct or interpret the raw data of experience in terms of our cravings, our conceit, or our desire to stand out, our need to be somebody special. Here, mana, conceit, doesn't necessarily imply that one is proud and arrogant, but at a more basic level, it could signify just the need to stand out, to be somebody special, to have some kind of sense of secure personal identity. And then when we allow these thoughts based on craving and conceit to start constructing more elaborate, theoretical and conceptual notions, or theoretical and interpretative notions, then they lead into views, these are full-fledged theories, especially theories about the self and about the ultimate nature of the world. Even though the commentaries mention these three factors at the root of papancha, of mental elaboration, craving, conceit, and views, but it seems to me that many other mental factors could enter into this work of conceptual elaboration. So, if we don't try to confine papancha to any specific set of factors, we could regard it more broadly as the process by which we build up subjective conceptual interpretations of our immediate experience, and then we become carried away by these conceptual constructions, so that they pull us into entanglement, or they oppress us or afflict us. So, for example, let us say I buy a new car and I'm very proud of it, and I leave the car in the driveway so that people passing by, the neighbors will look and they'll say, "Wow, he has a new car. What is it, a Prius? Is that the prestige car nowadays?" I don't know, because I don't really drive. Okay, so then a couple of weeks later, I say in my neighbor's driveway, there's Mercedes-Benz that's more prestigious than a Prius. So he has a new Mercedes. So what is the car in actuality? It's just, you know, a bunch of pieces of metal put together, painted a particular color. But we attach this prestige significance to it. And so when I pull into my driveway in my Prius, and then I see in my neighbor's driveway there is a Mercedes now, then I start building up, there comes this perception of the car, the identification, Mercedes, then there come comparisons. I have the Prius, he has the Mercedes, Mercedes more prestigious than the Prius. Everybody's going to be admiring him, not admiring me anymore. Then there comes envy, resentment. And so these mental thoughts all build up through the process of upancha. There is the raw perception. The raw perception gets processed. It turns into elaborated perceptions or fabricated perceptions. Those perceptions give rise to notions, comparative notions. There's a certain degree of conceit entering into this, where I'm comparing myself with him who is more prestigious. And then when I see that my conceit has been deflated because he has a better car than I do, then there comes a sense of oppression and affliction. And if I just remain at the level of bare perception, I could just say, he has his car, I have my car. One car is as good as another. Each car has its own purpose. But this all gets built up or processed and thought until it becomes the basis for even conflict, disputes, competition. Another personal example I'll relate to you, this is what I would take to be a case of friendship, not rooted in either craving, conceit, or views, but in fear, in my own experience. See, I try to get along peacefully with everyone. At least I think so. But when I was living in Kandy, in place Uduwatakeli, the hermitage in Uduwatakeli, there was one monk who was staying in our monastery who was making a lot of trouble for everybody, always getting into quarrels with them, sort of disregarding the basic principles of monastic etiquette. Okay, later that year, well, in 2001, I had gone to Singapore for some time, and the other monks who were staying there found that they had reached a point where they just couldn't live together with him anymore. And so they decided to call a meeting, and they even brought the chief monk from this particular division of the Sangha into the meeting, and the chief monk said to that troublemaking monk, "You have to live harmoniously with the other monks and follow their way of doing things, otherwise you have to leave." He apparently got angry and decided to leave. Okay, now, about half a year later, from Singapore, I went to Germany, to Hamburg. And now this monk who was making trouble, he was from Central Europe. And I knew that in the spring, he would often go to Europe and visit different countries in Europe. And so I was in Hamburg, and this was May, the time when they have the Vesak celebration, the celebration of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and nirvana. And they would have the Vesak celebration in the Hamburg Buddhist Center. And they invited, since I was in Hamburg, they invited me to come for that. And so a woman, her name is Monica, she drove me to the Buddhist Society in Hamburg. When we got out of the car, she looked into the building of the society and she said, "Oh, there's a monk in there." And I looked in, who is that monk? Looked through the window, and I saw a look like a monk sitting there. He turned around as we came out of the car, looked at me. I thought, it's him. What am I going to do? And I was thinking, what's going to happen now? Well, I walk into the room, he could get up, knowing his temperament, and confront me and say, "You were part of that conspiracy to get me kicked out of the hermitage." Or else he'll just sit quietly, and then maybe when I'm giving my talk, he'll get up in the middle of the talk and say, "You're talking about peace and love, but you're the monk." What should I do? Should I tell him, try to be peaceful and reconcile myself to him? Or should I try to tell him that he was the one who was making all the trouble and he should recognize the faults himself? So all of these scenarios were building up in my mind in the two minutes, 1 minute it took to walk from the car into the building, you know, go through the passageway into the main room. Dozens and dozens of scenarios were passing through my mind. Seeing him with all the expressions on his face that I knew from him, knew from him in the past. We came into the room and I looked. There's no monk here. But there is a layman who is wearing an orange colored shirt with very short hair, you know, just like the hair that long. The shape of the head was similar to that of the monk in Cathy. And so I realized in a flash that this woman, Monica, had misjudged the person seen through the window on the basis of the orange-colored shirt. That gave the cue to my mind to start, to my underlying fear of meeting that monk in Europe. So I projected the idea, that's him. And then through that misperception, that sanya, misperception, all of this papancha, this elaboration is taking place. And then in one split second, when I saw no monk in the room, all that papancha just came crashing down. Okay, so continuing. This is, at least this is the way I understand papancha sanya sankha. If there is nothing is found there to delight in, that is what takes delight in it through craving. That's the way the commentary interprets it. One welcomes it through affirming it and holding to it. All of these are activities of craving and clinging. Then this is the end of the, here the text enumerates the seven underlying tendencies. These are deep tendencies to the defilements which remain in the mind and which pop up to the surface whenever they are provoked to activity by any of the outer conditions or circumstances of our life. And so the Pali word here is anusaya. Translated as underlying tendency, it comes from the stem saya, which means to lie down, to be lying down. And it has the prefix anu, which has the sense of along with or to follow. So the anusaya are defilements which lie along with the stream of consciousness. And they follow us along from life to life. And whenever they find the opportunity, then they arise to the surface in the form of some kind of afflictive thoughts. So the texts mention seven of these underlying tendencies. One is the underlying tendency to lust, and here it's specifically sensual lust. Then there's the underlying tendency to aversion, to dislike. So those are two fundamental underlying tendencies. The lust, attraction, attachment to what is pleasant, and the aversion to what is unpleasant. But then there are several other underlying tendencies. The tendency to form views, the tendency to doubt, being unable to place firm confidence or trust in a particular spiritual teaching, the tendency to conceit, that is to construct and interpret experience in terms of I, and then using that sense of I to rate ourselves better, equal, or even worse. Then the underlying tendency to desire for being. This is the deep clinging to existence that drives one from life to life within samsara, the round of rebirths. And then the seventh, this is the deepest tendency, the tendency to ignorance, to not understanding things as they truly are. And so with this part of the Buddha's answer, he seems to be explaining the part of his original statement in which he said that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman. And here the verb underlie is the verb anusaya, which is the verb corresponding to anusaya. So the idea, the way I see it, seems to be that these underlying tendencies are provoked or activated by perceptions. That we perceive things, and then those perceptions stimulate the underlying tendencies so that they become active. And when they become active, then they lead to this papancha, this elaboration or fabrication in terms of distorted notions, ideas, and notions. So, for example, when I have the Prius and then I see my neighbor drive up in his Mercedes, first there's the perception, then that perception provokes or arouses the anusaya. The anusaya, the underlying tendency of, in this case, conceit. So my conceit is injured because my car is inferior to his. And then I start building up these papanchas, these distorted thoughts. Oh, everybody's going to be looking down at me because my neighbor has a better car than I do. Or that rascal, the middle of the night going to set off a firecracker, drop a firecracker into his gas tank. Or else I look through the window and then I see the perception of its orange, a patch of what looks like an orange robe and shaved head, and then that starts provoking this. So this would be an underlying tendency to fear, maybe worry, stress, what's going to happen when this confrontation takes place. So these are underlying tendencies being provoked by perceptions. Okay, then the second part of the Buddha's answer seems to be explaining how he does not quarrel with anyone in the world. So because of not delighting and welcoming in these sources of mental proliferation, then he says this is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, that's the instruments of violence, physical violence, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Verbal aggression. And then summing up here, these evil, unwholesome states or activities cease without remainder. Okay, now apparently the monks at that time weren't able even to understand the Buddha's explanation of his original statement. And so they say to one another, now the Buddha has gotten up from his seat, he's gone into his dwelling, and he's given just a brief statement without explaining the detailed meaning. Who will expound this short statement in detail? And then their minds turn to one of the Buddha's great disciples. His name is Mahakachana. And this Mahakachana was singled out by the Buddha as one of the special types of great disciples. The great disciples have different specialties. One is the foremost in wisdom, that's Sariputta. Another is the foremost in psychic powers, that's Moggallana. Another is the foremost in the ascetic practices, that's Mahakasapa. Another is the foremost in learning the Dharma, that's Venerable Ananda. And Mahakachana was the foremost in being able to take a short statement of the Buddha and give a detailed explanation of it. So for this reason, the monks go to Mahakachana in order to ask him to explain the Buddha's statement in detail. Then Mahakachana is very modest, and so he says, here I'm in paragraph 12, this is like a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in the woods in search of heartwood, but he looks for the heartwood, the solid core of the tree, among the branches and leaves, the twigs and leaves of the tree. After he passes over the root and the trunk, that's where the heartwood is to be found. And so, Mahakachana says, in the same way, you come to me asking me to explain the meaning of this statement, even though the Buddha was face to face to you and you didn't ask him. Of course, they should say, even though the Buddha was face to face with us, but he got up and went into his room and shut the door and left us out in the cold. Okay, so then he praises the Buddha as the one who knows and sees and so on. You should have asked, when you were with the Buddha, you should have asked him about the meaning. Shouldn't come to me. Okay, but the monks persist, and then Mahakachana says, okay, since you were insisting, I'll explain to you my interpretation. Okay, then he repeats the Buddha's statement in paragraph 15. Then he starts to give his explanation in paragraph 16. And this is a very important statement because it shows how cognition develops and unfolds and how it gets distorted at a certain point. So he begins with a stock formulation of the beginning of an act of perception. Dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. So for consciousness of a particular type to arise, we need the sense organ or sense faculty. In this case, it's the I. And we need the sense object. In this case, visible forms. And so I consciousness arises based on the I as the faculty of cognition and based on visible forms as the objects of cognition. And when the I consciousness encounters the objects through the I, this meeting is what is called contact. The contact, it's not the impingement of the forms on the eye, but it's the meeting of mind or consciousness with the forms through the eye. And that meeting is called contact. And dependent upon contact, there arises feeling. So every case of consciousness is accompanied by some feeling, either pleasant feeling, painful feeling, or feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant, what we call neutral feeling. And notice that up to this point, the entire process of cognition so far is all stated in very impersonal, objective terms. There's yet no mention of any subject of cognition, but there's forms, the eye consciousness arises, the meaning of the three, contact, with contact as condition, there is feeling. But with the next step, we see a subject start to emerge within cognition. What one feels, that one perceives. Now, you could say the idea of self, it's not yet come out explicitly, but it's a little bit like maybe the baby starting to, or the fetus starting to take shape in the womb. With one feels, one perceives. And so perception and feeling arise together. Then based upon perception, one starts to think. What is the word that's rendered by thinking here? It's the word vitakka. And vitakka thinking can sometimes be accurate, and sometimes it can be inaccurate. So the blame, according to the Buddhist teaching, it's not with thinking itself. That one thinks about. The thinking is vitakkheti. Then this is where the trouble comes in with the next step. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. Here the verb is puppancheti. Now, the process of thinking, which could have been traveling along a straight route, is now veering off to the side, to a byway. It's a little bit like taking a long turn in the road, and now it's starting to drive off to the side through papancheti, where one is mentally proliferating, starting to, through one's thinking, one is starting to distort the the objects of perception, or distort what is experienced. So it's now, if you follow the commentarial explanation, it's now getting distorted by craving is coming in, and so one's thinking is getting directed by craving. And so one is starting to think, what don't I have that I should obtain? Like the way this works, well, this is an extension of the simile that I gave, like people who have, you know, $5 million, like these Wall Street, they call them fat cat banks. You know, if you're getting like a bonus, $5 million, or $2 million a year, but then you see them, maybe you're a banker and Chase Morgan, it's a Morgan Chase. And then you're getting a bonus of $2 million, but then you read the newspaper, the banking executives at Goldman Sachs are getting $5 million. So you're $2 million, you feel like a pauper. How can I live on this? You know, I'm doing such valuable work for my bank, and they just give me $2 million? You know, with this I can only have 3 homes. And the other guys, maybe they have 5 homes, I have 3 homes. And so one is starting to think of this with thoughts of craving. I have to go and speak to my boss. If he's not going to give me a bonus of at least $4 million, I'll threaten to leave and get another job. My services are so valuable. Okay, so this is craving comes in here, or else one could be thinking of this as conceit. With conceit, isn't my work as valuable as that of their work? They're just treating me like I'm just expendable dust. I'm a qualified person. Okay, so it starts elaborating by way of craving, conceit. And then in India, in the Buddhist time, the more philosophically inclined people would elaborate on basis of their ideas and perceptions. We start to elaborate views and theories, especially the theory of the permanent eternal self. And so one builds up these mental proliferations. Again, it's an active verb with the subject in the active position. Then with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset, or we could say attack or oppress or afflict a person with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. In this sentence, through this mental proliferation, one builds up these perceptions and notions which are governed by craving, conceit, and views. And then those perceptions and notions, they become the subject, and the person becomes the object who is overwhelmed, oppressed, afflicted by those ideas and notions and concepts those mental constructions which he himself has constructed. So they become the, you say, they dominate their own creator. A little bit like in the Disney film, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The young apprentice, magician apprentice, he creates.
Mickey Mouse.
He creates those misapplied magic, some demons who then come running after him and attack him.
He makes a broom do his chore.
He makes a broom do his chore
that has been left him by the magician of taking the well water and filling all these things. And then he accidentally breaks the broom to try to stop it, and each of the pieces form another broom until there are thousands of brooms taking water from the well, and the whole home of the wizard becomes filled with water.
Yeah, that's exactly what's taking place here.
And he's drowning.
He's drowning in his own creations. Okay, then the same pattern is explicated with regard to all of the sense faculties, each of the other sense faculties. Now what this passage does, it also, even though it doesn't state this directly, but it indicates to us what is done in the development of Buddhist mindfulness meditation or insight meditation to break this sequence by which we get overwhelmed by our own mental creations. And so we have, sometimes we have in the formulation of dependent origination, we have feeling gives rise to, we have contact gives rise to feeling, feeling gives rise to craving, craving gives rise to clinging. And so then we say to break the chain of dependent origination, one has to insert mindfulness and clear comprehension between the links of feeling and craving. Okay, here we have almost the same thing being indicated, not with regard to craving as such, but in terms of more conceptual modality, with regard to cognition. So as we move from perception to thinking, okay, as long as the thinking is accurate, then it's acceptable. But it's when we move from thinking to mental proliferation that we take what I call this wrong turn. And so in the practice of mindfulness meditation or insight meditation, what one does is to keep on mindfully observing one's experience in order to forestall or prevent the perceptions and the thoughts from proliferating and getting out of hand and distorting the experience through concepts and ideas that are of purely subjective origin. So one tries to keep one's awareness at the most basic level so that as one experiences a feeling, one knows simply, I'm experiencing a feeling, or even more accurately, a feeling has arisen, conditioned by contact. If one experiences a thought, one knows a thought has arisen. If one experiences a perception, one knows simply a perception has arisen. But one doesn't allow the feelings, perceptions, and thoughts to continue this process in such a way that one builds up these imaginary mental constructions on top of the bare experience. We have the same principle indicated very concisely in the Buddha's advice, it's a famous advice to an ascetic named Bhatia, who came to the Buddha saying, please teach me the Dhamma. He's very, very eager to hear the Buddha teach. And so the Buddha said, I will teach you very concisely. In the seen, there should be only the seen. In what is heard, only what is heard. In what is sensed, only what is sensed. In what is cognized, only what is cognized. And so what is meant by this is that one keeps the experience of seeing as closely as possible to the bare experience of seeing. When one hears, one keeps simply to the level of hearing, not building up thoughts, for example, those sounds are disturbing me, or other senses, building up mental proliferations on that basis. I think I've told my story about the dogs barking, thinking, you know, when I started to meditate many, many years ago, this was when in graduate school, I would sit there. It would seem, up until that moment, everything is perfectly quiet. When I sit, start breathing in, breathing out, nice and quiet, breathing in, breathing out, very quiet, breathing in, breathing out, why is that? This would go on for days. Why is that dog walking just to disturb my meditation? It would be like a half an hour before my sitting time starts. I'm looking at the clock. Is it barking yet? No. 15 minutes yet? Barking yet? No. 5 minutes? Everything is quiet. The minute of sitting down, everything is quiet. But as soon as one gets into in-breath, out-breath, then this goes on building up, this whole thought of seeing the dog, wanting to strangle the dog. Even the point. I imagine myself getting up and going, tracking down the dog through the streets, going to their house, ringing the doorbell of the people, saying, please excuse me, but between 9 and 10 p.m., would you please put a muzzle on your dog? So he doesn't bark, since I want to meditate at that hour, and he's disturbing me. Then, in fact, I did go out into the street, and I hear the dog barking. I go down the street in that direction, and as soon as I get to the corner, so I know the street, but what house is it? I can't go to every house. I'm just on the block ringing the bell and saying, excuse me, do you happen to have a dog here who barks every night between 9 and 10 p.m.? So eventually I had to learn to live with the barking. But the way to get over that is simply, I mean, what is it all but interpretation? It's just the sound. So if you treat it just the sound, if you hear the barking, you just connote barking, barking. But even barking is an interpretation. So if you just bring it down to a further level, it's just a sound. And it's a sound that sometimes it arises, sometimes it passes away. And when I started to do that, after some time, the dog stopped barking. Okay, maybe I'll ask now, at this point, if there's any questions. Yes, Richard. Quickly, take these loving...
This isn't actually a question, it's a comment.
In Telugu, there is a habit that Telugu speakers have of sticking their tongues out. So the tongue wagging. People put their tongues out, and it's a common gesture like that. And it's like, I'm wagging tongues, right? And it's so much so that there are actually papers written on Telugu tongue extensions. And I'm thinking that it may be when he's wagging his tongue, it's the same tradition a little further north. That is, it's a gesture of contempt.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, contempt and doubt, like, oh, you know, you say it. So. Right, yeah, too, but that's what I think people are doing.
Yeah, it could be just a cultural custom which survived for thousands of years.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's a gesture, for instance, that in the Midwest often, farmers will have this gesture of licking their bottom lip with their tongue. You can slide your tongue across your lip, right? And that's an expression of doubt and standoffishness. Like, you know, it's a way of saying, well, I'm thinking about this, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's a similar
thing. Yeah, it could be a custom that goes back thousands of years and still survives. And Andhra Pradesh?
Yeah.
Is nobody from North India here? Or those North India customs? I'm just wondering if that custom still exists in North India. You know, there's an Indian custom. This also comes to Sri Lanka. The way of saying yes, it's not, in America we do this, but the way of a group, exactly. Somebody described it as if when we're using the chin to describe a figure eight. Anyway.
That's supposed to mean extreme pleasure. It's pleasurable, yes.
Yeah.
The head wiggle.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just fine.
Yeah.
In a way, this is related to the exchange that just happened, that idea of an almost involuntary reaction. Contact leads to feeling, and feeling leads to perception. This is a very basic question. It seems to me like when you describe the barking dog example, that mindfulness can help us change the quality of feeling.
Yeah.
It always bewildered me that feeling precedes perception.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. First, I'm not so sure that it's intended here that feeling precedes perception, even though it's stated. Because it says what one feels, that one perceives. And so this could indicate that the two are occurring simultaneously. So according to a sort of more refined Buddhist analysis of cognition, feeling and perception always arise together. But now what, on different occasions of experience, one or another is more prominent. And so sometimes feeling is more prominent, the feeling arises, and then that will condition a perception which will occur a little bit later than that feeling. Even though the feeling is accompanied by a perception of its own, but then the more prominent perception will arise after the feeling. But also, as you point out, what happens quite often is that the perception will condition a later feeling. Okay, to go back to the example of my friend in the Harvard Buddhist Society, when the woman who drove me said that there's a monk inside, when I looked, first all I saw was an orange robe, or what I took to be an orange robe, and so there would have been just a rather neutral perception along with that, or maybe even a pleasant perception, thinking, ah, there's another monk there. But then when the perception came, that's him. Then there came the feeling of a kind of displeasure accompanied by fear, worry, stress. So this is how your perception will ignite a feeling. There's somebody else in the front. Kim has a question.
Thank you, Chief. Bhante, thoughts naturally arise, so I don't think there's a way to stop the thoughts. But the problem is that the rising of the thought is that because once the thought arises, we cling into the thoughts.
We cling, we attach
to the thoughts.
Yeah, thoughts arise naturally.
Yeah.
But what is eventually necessary through mental training is to try to alter the quality of the thoughts that arise. This is done through, we recognize that there are unwholesome thoughts and wholesome thoughts. And so we try to replace unwholesome thoughts with wholesome thoughts. I'm going to deal with this more next class, next Saturday. So I won't elaborate on it now.
Thank you.
Bhante, you said when feelings and then one perceives, that one sequence, feeling and perceives, and feeling is more prominent.
Yeah.
That is, to me, it's more real. The other one, the perception, is more prominent.
Yeah.
That means it doesn't have the feeling as a base to it, like the dog. When you feel the dog was barking,
yeah,
maybe there's no dog barking.
Yeah.
In that case, that the perception without feeling, can this occur? Like a creative, a deluded perception.
They said that there's no perception without feeling, but in some cases the feeling could be very subordinate and the perception is dominant, so that we don't really notice the feeling. It doesn't stand out very clearly. Whereas on other occasions, the feeling is more is dominant, and the perception is somewhat in the background.
Thank you.
Okay, let me take the internet questions. Is papanchasanya sankha, mental proliferation, the same as speech formation linked to mind's fabrication? The three kinds of formations, body, speech, and mind. I'd say that they're two separate things. One could draw links between them, but the texts themselves, they're not explicitly connected. Okay, second question. The items in the 10 fetters and the underlying tendencies overlap. Why were the two grouped differently? Any significance? There's no mention of identity here or Sakaya Ditti and the abuses. Okay, there is some overlap between the anusiyas and the samyojanas. In fact, they're actually the same mental factors, but they're just, I think, they're designated in different ways in order to show different ways in which they function. When you call them, when the Buddha calls them samyojana or fetter, that highlights their aspect of keeping beings bound or tied to the cycle of rebirths. Whereas when they're called underlying tendencies, that highlights the aspect of following along in the mind with this tendency to rise up from time to time. And then identity view is included amongst the anusiyas under the underlying tendency to views. Yeah, I just want to go rather quickly through the rest of the sutta in 5 minutes. Okay, starting with paragraph 17, Here, this is a little puzzling to me, that Mahakachana reviews by saying when there's the I form and I consciousness, it's possible to point out contact. When there is contact, it's possible to point out feeling. When there is, feeling, it's possible to point out perception and so on. Actually, this is evident, self-evident. But then there's paragraph 18, which is a little bit puzzling. When there is no I, no form, no I consciousness, it's impossible to point out contact. No, when there's no contact, there's no feeling. When there's no feeling, no perception, no perception. When there's no perception, there's no pointing out of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, no pointing out of the perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. So the reason why I find this a little puzzling, it seems to be saying that the condition for ending proliferation is that there should not be I form and I consciousness. But actually, the way I understand it, there can be the I, there can be the form, there can be I consciousness. There can be contact, there can be feeling, there can be perception, there can be thinking. But it's from the stage of thinking that one prevents the stages of mental proliferation, and then the concepts of perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. So this is a little bit a puzzle, but I don't want to dwell on it now. Okay, so then after going through that review, then Mahakachana says, he just sums up, he says, when the Buddha, the Blessed One, got up from his seat and went into his dwelling after making that saying, that statement, and he repeats the statement, I understand the detailed meaning of this summary to be thus, the way I've just explained it. If you wish, you can go to the Blessed One and ask him the meaning of this. As he explains it to you, thus you should remember it. Okay, so then the monks, they express their appreciation to Mahakachana. They get up, they go to the Buddha, they repeat Mahakachana's explanation. And then the Buddha praises Mahakachana, paragraph 21. He says, Mahakachana is wise, he has great wisdom. And then he puts the seal of approval on it and he says, if you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in exactly the same way. That is the meaning of it, and so you should remember it. And Venerable Ananda brings in the simile of the honey bowl, which is what gives the sutta its name. He says, it's just as if there were a man who was exhausted by hunger and weakness, came upon a honey bowl. It's a bowl still made in India with flour mixed with a kind of, could be with bee's honey or this palm tree honey, and it's allowed to solidify to some extent. So it's very sweet. And so wherever he would taste it, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. And so too, any able-minded monk, wherever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Then Ananda says, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? And then the Buddha says, in that case, Ananda, you may remember it as Madhu Pindika, the honey bowl discourse. Okay, and that takes us to the end of the sutta. And then next week we will take the sutta on the two kinds of thought. So there we'll see how to train the mind of thinking. Okay, so we'll have to end now with the sharing of the merits. And then we'll have from 12 to about 12:30, we'll have discussion for anybody who wants to stay for discussion. Anybody who wants to stay, for anybody who wants to stay for the discussion, lunch will be available in the dining hall. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Share the merits with the devas, the buddhas or fear spirits, the nagas or dragon spirits. and all other beings. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga nidhika punyam dhananubo dhipa shiram rakantu sasinam. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga nidhika punyam dhananubo dhipa shiram rakantu desisam. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga nidhika punyam dhananubo dhipa shiram rakantu mantaram. Eta vata chabam nehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodam tu sabbe bhutanumodam tu sabbe sattanumodam tu sabba sampati sabbhya bhavagupadaya vichitato etandare satakayupapanna rupiya rupiya sanna sannina dukkha pochantu pusantu vibhuti.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.